1510 WMEX Quincy, Boston, and 101.1 FM W266DQ Weymouth.
WMEX Quincy, Boston. Streaming at WMEXBoston.com. And on your smart speaker, just say play WMEX.
The greatest hits of all time are back. This is the all-new WMEX.
WMEX Boston.
They singing all night, drinking wine, spooty, ooty, drinking wine. Wine, spooty, ooty, drinking wine.
That's right. Wine by Design with Len here on 1510 WMEX. Len is a certified wine educator with over 30 years in the wine industry. And each Friday at 6 o'clock, you'll learn a little something. And you'll learn even more after that here on Wine by Design. Here's your host, Len Prasuti.
Well, thank you, Ben, and welcome everyone to Wine by Design. I just wanted to mention that your calls are very welcome here as well. You can call WMEX at 781-834-9639. 781-834-9639. And any question is on the table. Nothing's off the table. Anything about wine, food and wine, how to serve it, what to serve it with, what to serve it in. Just wanted to mention that because some of our callers have been pretty knowledgeable, but we welcome beginners here. I was a beginner once. Everyone out there was, and that's the way I learned.
It's one of
the
reasons I currently am a beginner.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why I love doing this, because I had someone there to answer my question, so I thought it would kind of be fun to be here to answer some of yours. But if you're not comfortable over the phone, you can email your questions in at lenwmex@gmail.com or lenwmex@gmail.com. And you can listen to past podcasts, and they're all titled beautifully, so you know what topics are being covered, at WMEXBoston.com, or you can search Wine by Design on your favorite platform. Well, those of you that have been listening for a while know that I've been working on the Gennaro's Eatery wine list. And my God, I have to admit, I've been having a ton of fun with it. And I've shared a lot of the process, where we had six different barbers and I went through every single one and all of that. I spoke with Jerry earlier today, and my God, is he into the whole wine program. He's very excited about doing matches. I've actually put wines on his list specifically for specials that he routinely offers to make sure that there are things that are going to be really great wine and food matches there, as well as just with his food in general. And he's very, very into that. As a matter of fact, he shared with me that he's planning on changing the name of the restaurant from Gennaro's Eatery to Gennaro's and Son Bistro and Wine Bar. So that's how committed to the wine program he is. But as much fun as this has been, I've had to make some hard decisions. And listeners to the show know I'm a big fan of the wines of Ascari. Matteo Ascari. They've really long-time vineyards and winemakers, going back to 1880. They've always felt that the wines should be an expression of the vineyards from which they come, using the grapes of the vineyard, obviously, but they want to put their own ideas in there as well. And boy, that has never come home to me more than with Matteo Ascari. I've really had a chance to know him, geez, it seems forever. I think as long as I've been in the business, and I've had a lot of really kind of long one-to-one personal discussions with him about everything from his winemaking philosophies to his ideas on how much air to give one of his Barolos, the shape of the decanter, absolutely everything. The winery really became known internationally for its Barbera. But talk about putting your own stamp on things. Matteo resurrected this ancient method of making better wines called tortellato. And it's this technique by which you twist the grapes, the bunches of grapes, while they're on the vine, about a week or maybe two and even more weeks before harvest. So it's almost like the grapes are kind of drying, and that really concentrates the flavors and the acidity and everything even more. He really made a big splash with his Barbera. As a matter of fact, I remember when it first came out, Decanter Magazine, now this is one of the top wine publications out of London with masters of wine writing for them and all that. I sometimes quote them on some of their reviews. They're actually very good. They named his Barbera a wine of the month. Now, they only do 12 wines per year, and we're looking at the entire wine world. So for him to kind of capture that distinction was really amazing, and it really brought him to the fore. But the main problem with Ascari wines is the fact that they're all great. And I had a choice to make. He makes so many different wines. He makes Arnais, which is beautifully aromatic, the Gavi, Moscato. There's a Barbera d'Alba, Dolcetto d'Alba, Nebbiolo, single vineyard Barolos that are just fantastic and really sought after. He even does some interesting ancient grapes that you never see over here. He does this Perla Verga de Verduno that is really odd. It almost has a slight touch of Frizzante to it. It's kind of a lightweight red, but it's got this weird kind of crushed white pepper over this light kind of cassis fruit. But the wine's very light in alcohol and just a ton of fun to drink. But I had to make a decision, and I decided to go with one white and one red for the list. The kind of no-brainer was the Gavi. His Gavi de Gavi is one of the best routinely year in and year out that I've ever tasted. It's perfect in terms of its typicity. And by that, I mean, it tastes like Gavi. It tastes the way Gavi is supposed to taste. There's this beautiful minerality, little note of maybe almonds, a little touch of herbs. One of the hallmarks is this really beautiful, bright, refreshing acidity. The wine's really vibrant, works with food really well. The fruit's kind of like a dried pear fruit. But with his, I've noticed more often than not, this little touch of anise that I often get in great Gavi, many twice or more the price of his, that really does kind of set his apart. And again, he's doing that. All of his wines are just so reasonably priced. I mean, we're talking with almost all of his wines, except getting into the Barolos in that $20 give or take range there. But the other wine that I had to go with was his Barolo. Now, he has a number of different Barolos from different vineyard sites. He does the Serrano and a bunch of them. He does one from his signature vineyard and all that. They're always highly reviewed and highly rated and all that. But where I wanted to go and what I was looking for was a Barolo that's approachable in its youth. That's not easy. Barolos, by and large, need more time to come around to the point where they're ready to drink, and they need a lot of aeration when you're sitting down to drink them. But he does this beautiful three-vineyard blend. It comes from different sections of the Barolo region, La Mora, Verduno, Serra Lunga d'Alba. And this blend, he's purposely made so that people can enjoy a Barolo before it's 10 years of age or 20 years of age or something like that. And a lot of them really don't drink well before they've attained a certain amount of age there.
Len, I hate to interrupt, but we do have a caller on the line for you. And I wanted to make sure that you got that note. I know the desk arrangement's a little odd in here, but Molly.
I did not see it. Yes, thank you.
Molly from Boston is on the line right now, out of left field, so I guess Manny Ramirez must be patrolling out there today. And Molly, you're live with Len with Wine by Design.
Hi, Len. How are you?
Great. Welcome, Molly. Glad you called
in. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I was just in a liquor store, and I tried the new Decoy Featherweight. It's a lower-calorie Sauvignon Blanc, and I had no idea that Decoy was a part of the Duckhorn portfolio. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about what you think of Duckhorn.
Oh, wow. Duckhorn is one of my absolute favorite wineries of all time. Just out of curiosity, though, how did you like it?
I loved it. I thought it was so good.
Great. Yes. I've heard of it, and I'm really excited to eventually try it. But see, now you're doing a field report into the show for someone who's tasted something I haven't.
No way. You haven't had it? You have to go get some.
Are you kidding me? It's right at the top of my list.
Amazing.
I love the Duckhorn Sauvignon Blanc. It's always been one of my favorites. As a matter of fact, my single favorite Sauvignon Blanc, where they're making it a little bit more in the style of Bordeaux, where they're blending in a little bit of Semillon and they're giving it a little touch of oak. It is just absolutely fantastic. And they managed to get really great extraction while keeping it kind of light on its feet. They were one of the first that I remember with Sauvignon Blancs from the United States of high quality to use the Stelvin closure, which I'm a huge fan of. And, I can understand. I understand that they are taking the alcohol out of that, and so that it has the full concentration of flavor that they would get in their Sauvignon Blanc. But just, you know, a couple words about Duckhorn. I can't tell you how much I love that winery, because one of the reasons is they're such a great American success story. You know, Dan and Margaret Duckhorn started that winery back in 1976, and they made their first wine in 1978. Now, they had traveled to Europe, and they thought that Merlot could be a standalone grape when no one else was thinking of that. They were thinking in terms of blending and stuff like that. So his wine from this Three Palms vineyard is legendary. I mean, it took the wine world by storm. Everyone flipped over it, and it actually made the winery successful literally overnight. I have to admit, I have a warm spot in my heart about it, because I was visiting the winery a few years back, and they actually opened a bottle of that 1978 Three Palms Merlot. It was...
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was really incredible. And I counted upon in some of the greatest wine drinking experiences of my life, in that not only the wine lived up to its legend, but it was such a legendary wine. And to actually get a chance to taste the wine that started everything. And one of the things I love about Duckhorn is not only do they make great everything, you know, their Chardonnay, their Cabernet, obviously the Merlot and all the different grapes, but they started a number of years ago that Decoy line that is just phenomenal for value centric wines. I mean, they tend to run from around the $18, $22 range roughly. And wow, that they over-deliver. My God, their Merlot at the Decoy level is one of the best I found out there for that price range. And they're making phenomenal high-end wines, too. There's a wine that they've come out with very recently called Discussion, because I guess it came from when they were first talking about making wine, the kitchen table discussion, where they decided to go with single varietals, and now this one is a blend, and that's off the charts great, getting like 98 points scores and all that good stuff. But wow, I'm so glad you called in. It brought back memories to me. So I'm assuming you bought some.
I did buy some, and now I'm so excited to go back into the store and try the three palms, and the discussions sound amazing. So thank you for telling me all your stories. It's really cool.
Yeah. Again, you happen to hit a winery that I just adore. So Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you called. Well, don't be a stranger. You broke the ice. You know, you're welcome to call in.
Thank you. And I just have to say, I love your show. You do such an amazing job. So keep doing what you do.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that, Molly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a pleasant surprise. I was talking a little bit, I'm going to just jump right back in, about the Ascari Barolo. So it's something that he's consciously made that drinks quite well early on. And it's highly rated for its price. It tends to retail for around $60 or something like that in that range. It's got 93 points from Robert Parker's Wine Advocate, as well as the Spectator gave the current vintage, which is 2019. So that was one that I really jumped on. It's got all of the typical Barolo characteristics. It's got this cherry fruit, this earthy mineral going on there, a hint of licorice. You know, they talk about tar and roses when it comes to Barolo, and it does have a little touch of rose petal and a little bit of that underlying road tar, believe it or not, in terms of the earthiness. It doesn't come across as anything really standing out, but it just makes for such a beautiful whole, and it's drinking absolutely beautifully right now. I did talk to Jerry. He is going to be using decanters at the restaurant. So what I would suggest with that, if you're having an evening out, is order the wine when you sit down, have them decant it, have an app with a glass of white wine while you're waiting for the wine to come around. Barolos are never hurt by air. So anyway, and then hit the Barolo maybe 15, 20 minutes or a half hour later when it's starting to open up. So the list is exciting, and it's almost done. When it's finished, we're going to talk further about maybe doing a tasting of a number of the wines there. Obviously, I promise we will include the Barolo, and we're going to have a tasting where you get a chance to try a lot of the more unusual wines in this that are going to be on the list there. But I did also want to talk about a pretty amazing wine experience I had over this past week. We had the 1975 Lungarati Rabesco Reserva Vigna Monticchio. And that, back in the day, was a legendary wine. That's when Italy was just kind of starting to stand up straight in getting its winemaking act together. In the early 70s, that's when Tignanello came on board. And this wine from Umbria was considered to be one of the greatest wines of all of Italy. We actually had a chance to visit Umbria and had an amazing food experience in Orvieto. Beautiful, small, old town. We came across someone with, you know how people have carts where they sell popcorn and nuts and things like that on the street. Well, this was three major carts put together. There was a roasted boar. Had to be 10 or 12 feet long. I didn't measure it, but they're slicing the pork off the boar to order making sandwiches. My God, it was just fantastic. I swear, the sandwich, it was big Italian bread, so it was about 10 inches, maybe even a foot long, and boy, they piled on this really succulent, juicy pork. It was about 8 inches high. It was more than enough for my wife, Andrea, and myself. We got that with a bottle of the local wine and some local cheese and went back to this abbey that we were staying in. It's this medieval abbey. The walls were like 6 feet solid stone. It's back when they built them to withstand, you know, the marauding hordes or whatever, you know, to defend it. And had that on the balcony. It was just one of the most memorable wine experiences and food experiences of my life. But enough about that. Going on to the wine. It is a wine made from 100% Sangiovese. It's made from the Torgiano area of Umbria, where they do a really good job there. And at the time, they were really pretty close to as high a level in terms of Sangiovese as Chianti was with their Chianti Classico. They put it in barrique a little bit, and a beautiful kind of balance between power and elegance back in the day. Interestingly, Rubesco, the name, comes from the Latin rubiscare, which means to blush, as in a joyous meeting. You know, so the wine is so good that it makes you blush. And it is the Lungarotti's flagship wine. I had the bottle and still had the price tag on it. It was $20.69, which back then was a lot of money for wine. They released it, I think, about 4 or 5 years after a vintage date. But now here's the part where I was starting to get a little nervous. I did a lot of research with people online in the wine community, and there's someone there whose palate I respect that gave it 3 hours and said, "Yeah, it was fading. I don't know if I'd give it that much air again. You know, you might want to be careful." So that was compounded by the fact that there was serious ullage in the bottle. Now, ullage means it ullage is, I should say, the distance between the cork and the level of the wine when the bottle's standing up. Usually they fill it pretty close to the top. They give it a little bit of room, so if it's exposed to different heat and cooling, that it can contract and expand without pushing out the cork. But this one had about 2 inches of space between the cork and the wine. Not necessarily a good sign. So I'm reading all of this online and I'm saying, what's this going to be a candidate for the vinegar barrel? But we popped the cork with my Durant, which you needed because the cork was falling apart. But turns out there was a killer seal right at the end of it. The first about 3/4 of an inch was perfect. The ullage must have happened with just some kind of evaporation through the cork. I mean, we're talking a 49-year-old wine here. So pop the cork, and as I got the cork out, the beautiful aromas of the wine are wafting up. I'm saying, my God, what's this? I really did not expect that. So we decanted it, and we worked it so that the wine would only be in the decanter for about 20 minutes. As you know, we're fans of long aeration in decanters. So we started in on it right about then, and my God, was it lovely. It had these beautiful aromatics of a spicy, vibrant, earthy cherry. Now, with a wine 49 years old, I was expecting maybe like some dried cherry or something like that, but there was actually some primary dark cherry fruit there, which was amazing. But it still had all those kind of little hints of dead leaf and all those things that you would expect, but it's amazingly youthful. And as we were drinking it, at about the 45-minute going, closing in on the hour point where we were drinking it, even more kind of this meaty, earthy fruit was like pouring out of the bottle, and it became even more complex and more aromatic with the air. It was just an amazing experience. Now, even color-wise, there was this brickish orange on the rim when you're looking at the glass, but it had some deep plum color there too. So it was amazingly youthful. But there was still some tan in there for it to lose. So I have to admit, we finished it at about the hour and 15, hour and a half point, but we were wondering where it would go from there. Did want to mention the dish we had with it, which was a drop-dead perfect pairing. It's a dish that I learned to make from Vinicio Frattaroli of the Toscano Restaurante on Beacon Hill, excuse me. That back in the day was one of the, if not the Italian restaurants of the whole city. And I was calling on him when I was running a route way back when, and he saw how interested I was in food as well as wine, and actually took me back into the kitchen and taught me to make his signature dish, which he actually won a competition with when he was in the Navy. I guess it was all the Navy chefs were involved. And he called it parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, but there was double smoked bacon in it and some cream. My God, a lot of different little elements that just really came together so beautifully. And I have to give my wife, Andrea, credit. She's the one that actually made the dish. But that really was a drop-dead match. I could not imagine a better match. As you know, we're always looking for that top one percentile match where both the food and the wine are just working beautifully together. And boy, that was it. What I wanted to talk about a bit next, now that we're going into the spring, and I actually started this last week. I don't think I'm going to finish it this week, but it was an interesting experience we had matching wines with fried seafood. Now, we live in an area where some of the best fried seafood in the world comes from. We're within short driving distance in Essex to the Clam Box, Woodman's and Farnham's. You know, Woodman's where they created the clam. So we thought that we'd try Farnham's because we're back and forth about it. We've had some good experiences, some not great ones. And turns out here that this experience was phenomenal. We got some fried oysters, which were the best fried oysters we have ever had, along with some fried calamari and some fried clams. Now, we had everything set up, and our go-to wine with the oysters is the Regattiere Old Vine Muscadet, which I talked about last week, saying that it seemed out of sorts and seemed overly ripe. And I was thinking, yeah, it's the 2022 vintage. Are they going to a riper style? But what really bothered me was it didn't seem to really fit together well. The acidity wasn't working with the fruit. And anyway, huge disappointment, because that's one of the things that we thought we had worked out. We've been using that wine for years, the Stealth Enclosure. We bought a case of it. It was the first bottle in the case. And I'm saying, oh, no. And we had a Loire Sauvignon Blanc with the fried clams that were amazing, and a Mums Blanc de Blanc that worked with the calamari, but it was working actually better with the oysters than the Muscadet was. So what did happen, however, is we were so intent on coming up with another great match for oysters that within a week, we went back to Farnham's and kind of repeated the whole thing. Well, definitely did the fried oysters with the fried calamari, and this time a fish and chips. But what I wanted to mention is that Muscadet showed absolutely beautifully, exactly the way we remembered it. And we came to the conclusion that it was what we in the trade refer to as bottle shock or travel sickness, which I will go into at length, as well as mentioning what the other great and one very surprising matches that we came up with were. Well, looking at the clock on the wall, That's about it for tonight's show. You've been listening to Wine by Design with Len on 1510. I want to thank everyone for listening, and until next week, all the best in wine and life.